Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The wildly popular video sharing app TikTok faces an uncertain future after President Trump signed an executive order to ban it in the U.S. unless an American buyer is found by mid-September. Trump cited national security concerns to justify the executive order. Wall Street Journal reporter Georgia Wells covers social media and has been following the story. Welcome.
Okay, thank you.
So what are the president's concerns regarding TikTok?
So TikTok collects certain information about the people who use it. Our understanding is that data isn't so unlike the data that other apps that people might use collect, such as Facebook or Google. And It typically includes stuff like kind of your rough location information, kind of some profile information, sometimes depending on the permissions, it includes like your contacts, like your cell phone contacts.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason it matters in the case of TikTok is because the company is owned by a Chinese company. And the Trump administration is concerned that if the Chinese government were to ask the company for that information, that TikTok wouldn't be in a position to say no. TikTok has said it has not and will not provide that information. But this is the basis for the Trump administration's concern about it.
He said they worry that TikTok and other Chinese social media app WeChat provides a channel for the Chinese Communist Party to obtain Americans' proprietary information. Does he cite any evidence that that is a concern?
The Trump administration isn't particularly specific about why that would be a concern, although they do kind of reference the data that these apps collect. And they also point to the potential for the Chinese government to kind of attempt to influence Americans, whether through like propaganda that they push on the apps or also censoring content that would be kind of critical of the Chinese government. But in both cases, the concerns are more of a theoretical concern, at least as far as I'm aware, rather than pointing to specific incidents that have happened in the past.
ByteDance is the parent company in China, but it's run by an American, former Disney top executive Kevin Mayer, who took over in May. Why the stipulation for an American company to own it?
There are two factors at play here. One is the Trump administration sees an American company as the safer bet to be in charge of this data. Like, an American company won't be in a position to have to answer to the Chinese government, presumably, than a Chinese company would. But also at the same time, our understanding is there's a factor of wanting to see this as a win for American business, that if an American company has to become the owner of this app, that it kind of signals something about like the power and the primacy of the American tech sector, which is notable because TikTok is the first Chinese app, like Chinese consumer app, that really has hit it huge in the U.S. It's like on the phone of almost every teenager in this country, it feels like right now. And for years, Chinese companies have been accused of copying rather than innovating their own products. But here's an example where a Chinese company has come up with a new app that's like absolutely taken off here.
Does it really illustrate American primacy when the president has to get involved with an executive order to demand it?
That's a great point. Perhaps not in a clean way, but it does. Like, stepping back, I think it could be viewed as sort of American companies kind of wresting ownership or taking control of an app that was like a Chinese invention but has been very successful in this country. Like, perhaps the way you get there isn't as clean, though.
How realistic is that September 15 deadline to close a deal of this magnitude? I mean, it's huge.
Yeah. No, that's exactly the issue. I was chatting with lawyers last week who specialize in kind of both corporate deals and also international regulatory issues. And they were saying that the amount of diligence that goes into something like this, typically, if there weren't this 45-day deadline, that diligence could take 6 months because any prospective buyer will want to know like every detail about what they're buying. And so, and you know, things like debt or kind of are there any liabilities or kind of things that are in the works. And imposing a 45-day deadline on that severely crimps kind of the ability of any of the interested parties to do the types of diligence that they would typically require.
Is it utterly clear that this executive order is legal?
TikTok has said that it will challenge it. However, this is such a new, we've never seen anything like this before. I think, but so, like, you're kind of hitting at the heart of the matter that, I don't think it's completely clear that it's legal, but also it's not completely clear that it's illegal. Like, we haven't seen an example of a company either, you know, becoming forced to do this or successfully fighting it. So I'm quite gripped to see what's going to happen.
Another unusual factor in all of this, Microsoft has consulted with President Trump over this business deal. That seems like an unusual amount of presidential involvement in a private business deal.
Deal maker in chief is not something we've heard of. No, I completely agree.
Well, yeah.
Our understanding is the Trump administration has been kind of reaching out to interested parties to kind of gauge their interest and see whether or not they want to participate in this deal, which is, again, like, not something I've ever covered in the past or have ever heard of happening. But one explanation is that the Trump administration is quite motivated here to see TikTok kind of, you know, end up with an American buyer. So that could be kind of propelling them to reaching out to these buyers.
Obviously, there's a political piece to all of this. The president's been trashing China pretty regularly in recent times, and that American primacy issue plays into the political drama as well, right?
Right. I mean, the executive order last week, what was interesting about it was it included not just TikTok, which is, you know, the company I've been covering for months, but also WeChat, which is this popular messaging app. And by broadening this, like, previously Trump has been for months critical and concerned about TikTok, but by broadening it to include WeChat, it broadens this targeted concern into, like, a larger attack on Chinese internet companies.
Talk about the significance of WeChat.
So WeChat's the most popular app in China, but it's also quite popular among Chinese and Chinese American people in the U.S. And so it's this messaging app that's not, like, the basics of it are not totally unlike WhatsApp or Signal or any other messaging app you might use. But what makes it special is it has these apps built on top of it. So you could, like, message with a dentist's office and kind of line up an appointment on WeChat. Or you can also pay for things on WeChat. And it's hard to, like, emphasize just how popular and big this app is in China. And also, it's, like, the main way that folks in the U.S. stay in contact with their friends and relatives in China.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really significant kind of, like, threat to that communication and how it occurs. Like, you know, surely people could hop to other apps, but it's a big deal.
Yeah, and it's a big deal to Apple as well, right, with its iPhone?
And its iPhone, but, I mean, the reason it matters for companies like Apple is that under this executive order, they'll be prohibited from transacting any business with the apps. And so, like, it's not just a ban on users. It's also, presumably Apple or Google can't provide cloud services then to WeChat. Like, I don't know if Google provides cloud services to WeChat, but the point being is it kind of prohibits any sort of business between the apps and American companies.
What about Twitter? Apparently it has interest in this. Do they have the means?
Twitter has expressed interest. What's interesting about the sale is our understanding is TikTok could go, or they're looking for tens of billions of dollars. And Twitter doesn't have that kind of cash lying around. But also, most companies are investors. They either don't have that much money lying around, or if they do, they're often not looking to put that much money into, like, a single asset, just in terms of a risk profile.
Right.
And so our understanding is that currently there's folks talking about kind of building, like, a group of investors and a company or to put in a bid together. And so I'm very interested to see whether or not, like, a company like Microsoft will go it alone and kind of put in a bid for TikTok, or if we might see a company like Twitter kind of teaming up with investors. For example, Silver Lake has a large stake in Twitter. And so, you know, they're one of the investors I'm keeping an eye on, because I haven't quite seen a sale like this. And the details of how it could be structured are quite interesting and unique.
The president also said that the U.S. Treasury should get a quote unquote substantial cut from the sale of TikTok's U.S. unit. What the heck is that about? I don't get that.
Again, I mean, something that I've never seen before.
Okay.
And so, but it's also a deterrent for potential buyers. So our understanding is the buyers who are, you know, who have expressed interest, even if they are interested, they don't want to be kind of writing a large check to the U.S. Treasury.
Mm-hmm.
And so at the same time, while the Trump administration is kind of working to broker kind of such a deal, also, some of the statements are also kind of undermining the interests of some of the interested parties, such as this payment to the Treasury.
But not Microsoft.
Well, even Microsoft, I mean, our understanding is Microsoft had been in discussions with TikTok before Trump said anything about a payment to the Treasury.
Okay.
And so what I'm, you know, working to figure out is whether or not that payment will throw any cold water on their interest.
It is interesting that the parent company ByteDance hired a former Disney top executive, Kevin Mayer, to run the company. What do you make of that? I mean, that was just in May. Is that all part of this, you know, drama?
Yeah, I mean, Kevin Mayer has said that he has a certain familiarity with family-friendly content. And so there's this bucket of criticism of TikTok that the app could be used to kind of push propaganda or pro-Chinese views or kind of that sort of thing. And I think Kevin coming from Disney shows that he has a familiarity with how do you kind of toe the line with certain topics? How do you kind of allow some content, but when do you know if it's kind of going to go over the edge? And so Kevin also has experience with releasing film, like Disney films, in China. So he understands both sides, kind of this, both governments that this company has to do extensive business with, he knows very well. I mean, it's a fascinating placement for an executive.
Hmm. Yeah, what an interesting challenge. Does the president have any other grudges against TikTok? I'm thinking Sarah Cooper right now.
TikTok has been used in ways, users have attempted to humiliate the president on TikTok in different ways. What we haven't been able to figure out is kind of to what degree is that influencing the president's kind of outlook on the company mm-hmm. currently. Also, if you recall, at the president's first major campaign kind of re-election event in Tulsa, users kind of banded together on TikTok to kind of tell each
That's
other
right.
to reserve tickets. Right, for the convention, mm-hmm. and then not show in an attempt to leave the stadium empty. In fact, the stadium was largely empty, but the Trump administration says that it didn't have anything to do with TikTok. Either way, like, for sure, users have attempted to humiliate the president on TikTok. But I'll note that there is a very large community of young conservatives on the app as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so certainly, our understanding is the campaign has been keeping those users in mind at the same time when they're thinking about, you know, this potential ban. But, like, yes, that's a way of getting back at people who, you know, would have been perceived to have kind of done wrong. But on the other hand, there are core members of the president's base on this app who his campaign will not want to piss off.
Well, speaking of which, we're just about out of time, but I want to ask, what about the world of, the universe of TikTok? What are the users? How are they responding to this? I don't know how many of them have much power to do anything, but as a group, they're huge.
Yes. No, they 100%. The president should likely not underestimate their power, but also just in terms of what they're doing, literal tears. I've been kind of scrolling through videos of TikTokers quite literally crying at the prospect of losing their platform in the U.S. Yeah.
And then just as an outgoing thing, describe to listeners what TikTok does, what the foundation of its, what delineates it, what distinguishes it.
Yeah. So the app really has kind of two separate pieces of secret sauce. The first is these 15-second short videos that the user watches. And they're not totally unlike the videos that you might see on YouTube, except that they're vertical, full screen, kind of made for your phone. And so it's like if you're just standing in line somewhere waiting, it's the perfect little snackable, lighthearted content. But the other thing that makes the app so sticky is the algorithm that it uses to show videos that the app kind of predicts you will enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
And just like watching friends kind of download it for the first time, it's remarkable how quickly the app will figure people out. And so, like, I have a friend who's really into, like, a woodworking studio, woodworking projects.
Mm-hmm.
And within it felt like an hour or so, he was receiving these videos of different, like, woodworking projects that were just making delightful little like cars and different cutting boards and stuff that like were visually very appealing. And it was shocking to me how quickly the app would figure that out about a person.
Well, Georgia Wells, I appreciate your time today. Hopefully we can check back with you as things unravel or wind up on all of this.
Yes, please. Thank you, Anne.
Georgia Wells is a reporter. She covers social media companies for The Wall Street Journal. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The tech industry remains overwhelmingly white and male-dominated despite corporate assurances to increase diversity at all levels. In tech fields, the percentage of Black employees range from 1.5% at Facebook to 9% at Apple, and that's as of 2018. A few years ago, a conversation between late music legend Prince and CNN commentator Van Jones about the diversity deficit led to an initiative called Hashtag Yes We Code, which is now Dream Corp Tech, a national boot camp program that trains young people for guaranteed jobs in tech fields. Michelle Ferguson is the National Community Initiatives Director for Dream Corp Tech. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Kumbi Tenoya is a journalist and founder at Urban Geeks. It's a global web-based news organization highlighting Blacks in technology. She is also an MSNBC and a Rise News on-air contributor. Welcome to the show, Kumbi.
Thank you so much.
So, Kumbi, why has it been so tough for people of color to get into and get promoted in the technology fields?
Well, and I'm actually, before I even answer that question, I just want to quickly, I suppose, mention why I actually launched Urban Geeks, because this is exactly why I launched Urban Geeks. When I spotted the lack of diversity in the tech industry, and particularly, you know, women and underserved minorities, I think there's two reasons, really. I think one of them is pattern matching. So I know that there's this whole discussion about the leaky pipeline, and I'm going to mention that, and I think that's a huge, you know, one of the main issues. But I think pattern matching is a really big issue here. Employers tend to employ people that look like them, that went to the same schools as them, that are the same demographics as them. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, particularly in Silicon Valley, places like Silicon Valley and the big tech companies, one of the reasons has got to be the fact that you employ people that you're comfortable with. It's people in your comfort zone. So I think that's one of the main reasons. And then on the flip side, and I know Michelle will probably touch more on this, also the actual, you know, we need minorities, underserved minorities and women to actually be trained up in technical roles. So those are, for me, the two main issues.
And that's that leaky pipeline issue where they're dropping
Absolutely.
Out at different points during that process.
Yes. Absolutely, absolutely. That's the leaky pipeline issue where we're not seeing enough people of color and women come through. Saying that, and I'm still when I think about this whole conversation about the leaky pipeline, mm-hmm. I don't want the whole emphasis to be on people of color to get trained up. This is a two-sided argument. It's the leaky pipeline and there has to be a responsibility for the tech industry to actually employ, you know, people of color and women.
So to become aware of the pattern matching and overcome that.
Yes, absolutely.
Michelle Ferguson, talk about how Prince and Van Jones came together to form a tech initiative in the first place. Van Jones was talking about molding Black Zuckerbergs, referring, I guess, to Zuckerberg of Facebook fame.
Yeah, so Van Jones and Prince were, you know, friends long before they started Yes We Code. So the Yes We Code initiative was started out of the Trayvon Martin incident. Hmm. You know, Van was very upset that, you know, someone, you know, a Black male in a hoodie is labeled as a thug or a criminal, but someone like Mark Zuckerberg at the time, who was wearing hoodies and flip-flops all the time, was seen as a tech genius. So he wanted to shift the narrative of what it means to be a Black man in a hoodie. So Prince challenged that idea and said, well, maybe we're not putting enough Black males or Black people at, you know, at all in the tech industry. And that's how Yes We Code was formed. We initially were training young adults, middle school and high schoolers, to learn how to code. Then in 2018, we shift our model to focus on adults and getting them in the door for tech jobs in very unconventional ways.
So much of it starts, though, to go back to the leaky pipeline issue, and not to put too much emphasis on it, but it does start. We know this with gender, the leaky pipeline for gender discrimination is a big issue. I mean, you have to get the idea early that you can succeed, right?
Exactly. You know, in our cohort, we deal with what's called the imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
We found that a lot of our participants, you know, they have the skills, whether it's formal or they are learning on their own, but they are afraid to compete in this market because they feel they don't belong, because this space hasn't created for them to feel like they can't belong. So it's definitely two-sided. You know, we have a leaky pipeline, but we also have an industry who doesn't put in enough initiative to make retention a forefront for them to retain the talent that they have and to remove those microaggressions that they have in the industry as well.
Kombi Tenoya, you report on the tech industry, and your web-based organization, Urban Geeks, highlights the accomplishments of Black people in tech. And I think, obviously, there are, you know, really famous examples now. I'm thinking of Hidden Figures, for instance, that the mainstream media has overlooked over time. What are some others that concern you and that you think people ought to know about?
Yeah, and actually that goes back to why I launched the brand. And this is a really big thing for me. When I launched Urban Geeks, it was very much I wanted to have a platform where we had positive role models. You know, people of color that are achieving great things in the tech industry, or more than often are not actually going out there on their own. So that's really important, actually. And when we even go back to the leaky pipeline, I think role models and representation is a really big factor. If people see, you know, young people see people that look like them that have achieved something in tech or, you know, started a tech company, that's really, really important. And aside from that, there are so many talented players out there. You know, we have people like, I mean, if I think about Atlanta, we have an amazing woman called Jasmine Crowe, who has a company called Gooda, which is trying to tackle food scarcity. We have another great founder called Sheena Allen, who has a fintech company, and she's and it's very much focused on you know, millennials and underserved minorities who actually are having problems getting into the actual financial, you know, the mainstream financial ecosystem. There's so much talent out there.
Mm-hmm.
There really is. There's so much talent out there. So I think for me, Urban Geeks is very intentional about actually showcasing this talent with the hope of inspiring, educating, and informing young people, not just young people, everyone really, that you can actually, you know, if you want this enough, you can actually get from, you know, you can actually make your way into this industry.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher, and we are talking about how the tech industry remains overwhelmingly white and male-dominated, despite assurances from the industry to increase diversity at every level. You just heard from Kombi Tenoya. She is the founder of Urban Geeks. It's a multicultural digital news platform focused on technology, science, business, and startups. Also with us, Michelle Ferguson, the interim national director for DreamCorp Tech, which is an initiative that came out of a conversation between the late Prince and Van Jones. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Kombi, you've said that mainstream tech also overlooks the growing multicultural market, and I think this is so important. There's money to be made.
Absolutely. And this is it. And I think it's when you kind of talk about it in terms of the bottom line, because, you know, people, when it comes to, I think the whole thing, they have all these diversity initiatives and people think that they're actually doing minorities a favor. But mm-hmm. You've got to look at the bottom line. And that, for me, goes back to the demographics. And whether, you know, at the end of the day, you know, statistics are saying by 2040, 2050, America will be a majority minority. What does that mean? It means that there will not be one group that is a majority in America. What does that mean? That means that your consumers are going to be diverse. You know, the people that you serve are going to be African-American, Latinx, Asian, Caucasian. So that means that you actually need to get people into these industries because they can produce products and services that actually consumers will use, a diverse base of consumers will use. So yeah, it's, I mean, I think when you talk to people, you start bringing out the stats and start actually waving that dollar sign, mm-hmm. then it becomes a more, you know, appealing argument that really we need to, it's all about the bottom line.
But you know, Michelle Ferguson, that issue has been raised countless times now over my, you know, as long as I've been covering these issues about women and women in leadership roles in companies. And the statistics don't lie. It shows that women who are running companies tend to do better, that women in leadership do better. They make more money. But it's when you look at the boardrooms in the U.S., they're still largely white and male.
Yeah, they're white, male, and they're also Asian. There's definitely a lack in diversity and for tech for women as well. That's also an issue that we're trying to combat. You know, we are using the technologies. We are here. And you need us to help, you know, help with algorithm bias and coding bias. That's why we're so prominent in pushing this agenda of you have to get more diversity in tech. Because algorithms, they control what kind of campaigns you see on your phone, what information you get, even how police are dispatched to your house when you have an emergency. So it's very important. But women are leading that space. A lot of the meetings that I do have with companies, it's women at the table saying, hey, we need help. This is our initiative. How do we get here? Not that men aren't doing it, but they're not seeing or are not pressing the issue as hard as women are because they understand because they are once at the other side of the table being locked out of an industry that they wanted to get in as well.
You are focusing on a few major metro areas, Michelle. Minneapolis, Prince's hometown, home of Target, which I didn't know. You have a partnership with Target. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so we are launching our second Twin Cities cohort in October. We are looking to have 15 to 20 aspiring software engineers who want to learn Java. They have signed on. They recognize the need to have more diversity in their company. They have really led in that initiative as their company overall, even in the retail space, of getting more Black products in their stores. So they understand the need of having more African-Americans on their engineering team. To help with the product and services that they offer, you know, via online as well. So we'll be launching that in October. You don't have to have coding experience to be in the program. It's free to all participants. We provide a monthly stipend of $1,000 per month. We provide the computers, the hardware, the software. We are here to help fill the gap and fill the need.
This is an interesting time in history, obviously. We have this intersection of the pandemic and the economic upheaval of that, which I think we haven't even gotten close to seeing, you know, what it's really going to be like. And also we have the Black Lives Matter, George Floyd protests, the intersection of those two things. I don't know. What do you think? Is this an opportunity, Kumbi Tanuya?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is I personally feel that what's happening is unprecedented. And I really believe it's unprecedented because I think this is one of the first times where you're actually seeing, and just to put it very bluntly, white people, you know, Caucasian people. I remember watching a video about a demonstration in Berlin, you know, which has very few minorities. So I actually think that this is actually a really significant historical moment where all people are actually, you know, Black, white, Asian,
all over the world.
You know, yeah, all over the world.
Yeah.
It's a global thing. Are actually really waking up to the fact that there is a system in place where there's the oppressed and the oppressor in very simplistic terms. So I really think that this is definitely a moment for us to stop and slow down. COVID's obviously forced us all to slow down and actually really see what we can do to move forward. I do believe this is definitely a time of, you know, opportunity and growth and really for, you know, people of color to actually start really, you know, having more of a voice.
And Michelle Ferguson, some large tech companies have been opening up their wallets and reaching out. And I'm wondering how these strike you, sincere, lasting, short-term facade. What do you think?
You know, that's kind of, you know, both sides of the coin. Mm-hmm. You know, for us, COVID was an opportunity. But George Floyd allowed us to have deeper conversations and be able to call out, this is systematic racism in play. How do we fix this? But they are opening their wallets, you know, putting up millions of dollars to put the initiative forward to have more Blacks and Latinos in the tech industry. But at the same time, even though they're looking to hire these these individuals, there has to be a plan on how to retain them.
Yeah.
You have to do a big dive into your company and do an assessment of where do we have these layers? Where do we have these barriers? Where do we have processes that are discriminatory or have these microaggressions against the very people that we're trying to retain? Yeah. So if you're not really focusing on how to retain that talent, you're going to have that leaky pipeline. You're going to have what Dr. Kaper calls is diversity is filling a bathtub with the drain open, which is what's happening. If you look at 2016, where high tech had 7% of Blacks, now look at 2020, you know, we have about 5%. People are starting to leave high tech because they don't feel like they belong and they feel discriminated against. And you're looking for employees to fix a problem that they aren't contributing to. You know, a lot of tech companies have ERGs, which are employee resource groups, looking for them to fix the problem of the systemic racism within the country or within their organization for free. And they don't, and that's not their job. You know, there needs to be someone who's a come in who has that skill set to assess what's really going on. So it's twofold. You have to put the money, you know, to retain the talent. You have to put the money to train the talent as well.
And Kumbi, I mean, it comes right down to the words we use, right? I mean, the lexicon of technology is male and white.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really wanted to just follow up on Michelle, because that is so important, retention. It's one thing having these big diversity campaigns, getting people into these specific roles. And then it's another thing, them actually being there and feeling comfortable and, you know, feeling that they're in an inclusive environment where they can grow and thrive. So that's something that's really important. Get in there, but you want to get in there and you want to grow and you want to feel supported and you want to thrive. Just something I really want to touch on before we sort of finish off, because I don't think we've really touched on this. So aside from, obviously, lack of diversity in the tech industry, another big issue is the fact that women and underserved minorities, even if they have these great ideas for tech companies, they struggle to get the big checks,
right?
Funding. There's a huge disparity, and, you know, we have all these figures out, 0.X% of Black women have raised, you know, over $1 million. So that's another big thing as well. You have these great ideas, but there's also, you know, a major issue in the VC community. Actually, you know, venture capitalists actually willing to write big checks for underserved minorities and women. And that's a huge issue, particularly if they want to build companies that really scale and have a global footprint. They often need that kind of financial support.
We've talked about that before on the show several times now. It's really, I mean, we talk about tech venture capitalists all the time, but it does not. I mean, it's another reflection of the issue. It's just not filtering down to women and people of color.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It really isn't. And that's a huge problem. You find, I mean, obviously the work that I do, I speak to, you know, a lot of founders and startups. And one of the issues is that they may, you know, they can do the friends and family round, the angel investor round, you know, if they're lucky, they can get to that phrase. But then when it starts to get to, we're talking about Series A, Series B, Series C, when you're starting to get to the really big checks that really can force you to be the next Uber, you know, and that's really where there's also another big problem as well. It's just a lot harder for women and underrepresented minorities to actually raise that kind of money.
And Michelle Ferguson, how important is it that you're offering this kind of training free with a stipend? It makes me think about the billionaire who paid off all the student loans. I think it was at Morehouse College for the graduate. I think the graduating class of 2019 or 2018. It's really interesting to see how that's playing out. It's important because why?
It's very important. You know, our program is very extended. You know, it's kind of tedious, to be honest. It's Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. And even after that 9 to 5 hour, they have projects they have to work on and bring to class and present on them. But we realize what our demographic is. They're not, you know, coming from money. They don't have inheritance fund. They don't have, you know, a backup fund or a savings account to rely on while they're taking our courses for 8 to 10 weeks. So it's helpful for us, or very important for us, to give them some type of financial backing. For better terms, to help mitigate any barriers that may impinge upon them completing our program. You know, we realize this is very important. You know, most, you know, boot camps may cost you $10,000 to $20,000, and they just don't have it, because if they did have it, they wouldn't be going through our program.
Right.
So it's very helpful. It's very important for us to provide them that financial backing while they're going through our program. And we also frame that to our partners, why our program's only 8 to 10 weeks versus, you know, a 16 to 24 week program somewhere else. It's the type of talent that we're bringing in. They're really untapped jewels in the communities that we're looking to hire from. And then, you know, with the success of our past cohorts, they really see that. And they're really quick to understand and to give the money to provide that financial backing while they're going through our program.
Well, Michelle Ferguson, Interim National Director for Dream Corps Tech, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it and best wishes.
Thank you. You too.
Kumbi Tenoya, founder of the Urban Geeks, a multicultural digital news platform focused on technology, science, business, and startups. Kumbi, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
And we have more Tech Tuesday coming up with Russell Holley. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. President Trump's executive order related to TikTok and WeChat could have far-reaching effects for U.S. tech companies, specifically Apple. Much of daily life in China runs through the WeChat app on iPhones. One analyst predicts iPhone shipments worldwide could decrease 30% if WeChat is pulled from the phones. Android Central contributing editor Russell Holley is here to tell us more. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So we talked about the president's executive order and TikTok at the top of the show, but tech companies such as Apple do huge business in China with WeChat. It's owned by Tencent. Just how big of a hit would this be potentially?
Well, I think it's first important to understand, you know, how WeChat works as a platform in China, and in fact, several places that are not China and not the U.S. WeChat is almost the operating system in China. It is how you look things up if you're looking for directions to get somewhere. It is how you pay for everything. If you pay virtually in China, you don't, you know, use a separate app like Apple Pay like we do here in the U.S. It's just a QR code inside of WeChat. There's just a ton of business that is done on a corporate level inside of WeChat every day, including with people in the U.S. I've had several projects that I've done with Chinese companies that have happened almost entirely through WeChat. And Apple doesn't allow you to sideload applications. So if the American company Apple is told that they can't have WeChat on their platform, there is no way for people in China who own iPhones to put WeChat on it. It's completely impossible to do so.
Why is it? I don't get that. Why?
It's a security feature that Apple has.
Okay, gotcha. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, that makes it so that you can't install something that doesn't come from the Apple Store. There used to be ways to bypass this through jailbreaking, but Apple's gotten very, very good over the last couple of years, making it harder and harder to jailbreak. So if this happens, there's a tremendous amount of people in China who use WeChat on iPhones that will suddenly not be able to.
And what the president wants to do is prohibit anybody from being able to do that. I mean, it can't be in the Apple Store. It can't even be a choice.
Right. The Apple Store is maintained by Apple, which is a U.S. company. So the ban would make it so that no version of the Apple Store, no version of the App Store could have WeChat on it. Not a special, you know, Chinese version of the App Store or anything like that. As long as it is maintained by an American company and existing on the iPhone, Apple would have to, in order to support WeChat on its platform, Apple would have to dramatically change the way iOS itself functions. And it's not going to do that. So this has pretty significant, lasting possible consequences for iPhone sales in China.
And what's Apple saying about all this?
Right now, Apple's been pretty quiet about it. They've been hoping that this is something that gets resolved before the deadline on the 15th. It's still not entirely clear, like so much of this, whether. The deal with TikTok potentially being sold to either Microsoft or Twitter or several of the other companies that are currently bidding for it right now, mm-hmm. if that would even impact the ban on WeChat. There's a lot that goes into that.
And to uninstall WeChat, is that feasible for Apple to do?
No, Apple wouldn't be able to uninstall WeChat. Anyone who has WeChat currently installed on their system would still have it.
Okay.
It would no longer be able to be installed on new iPhones. So essentially, anyone who had it on their phone right that second, the software would still be there, but there would be no software updates. There would be no new features. that were rolled out that way. And in order for that to function, you know, there would have to be, you'd essentially have to get an Android phone, and you'd have to be able to install WeChat, you know, in a different way, you know, because Android phones allow you to uninstall from what are called unofficial sources. So you'd be able to get a phone, you know, that was likely then made in China, and then, you know, use WeChat that way.
That's interesting. It could benefit those companies because it's not an insignificant base here, right?
Correct. Yeah, this is a massive, you know, Apple and Google both have slowly been making the push into China over the last couple of years, and the results have been phenomenal for Apple's bottom line. You know, the sales of iPhones in China have been, you know, explosive over the last couple of years.
Any other companies or suppliers that could be impacted by this?
Not really. I mean, you know, this will cause a slowdown for you know, kind of global traffic in general. So, I mean, there are some network infrastructure companies that may see a decrease in communication that would be temporary. But really what would come down to is people who wanted WeChat would have to press a few more buttons in order to install it on an Android phone. But it would be such a temporary thing for things that aren't the iPhone that it would be, you know, it would be a negligible thing over time.
Okay. Microsoft plans to bring Project X cloud streaming platform into service, but it's locked out from iOS devices. Is this the same old thing?
This is such a weird thing, actually. Apple. So, you know, Microsoft has been working on this game streaming platform for a little while now, where you can, from your phone, play any game that is available on your Xbox. And it works very well. The demo that has been happening on it so far has been really successful. There have been several companies that have made special controllers just for your phone that have the Xbox buttons on it. And it's been, you know, the internal testing has been pretty successful. We know that the plan is to make it an official part of what's called Xbox Game Pass on September 15th, making it so that anything that you can play through Xbox Game Pass, you can then just play on your phone. It's going to be a really powerful thing. For anyone that owns anything but an iPhone, because Project X Cloud was originally demoed on iOS, it will actually not be released on iOS. And Apple has said that they have asked Microsoft to stop development because it violates the store policies for the app. What Apple is referring to there is a rule that says that if you install something that allows you to play things that don't live on the App Store, Apple has to approve the things that everyone has access to. So basically, mm-hmm. Apple would have to approve every single game that was available on the Apple version of Xbox Game Pass, and Microsoft is not willing to make that concession. And honestly, you know, it would be an impossible thing to maintain. Apple would basically have to give permission to what would eventually be tens of thousands of games that would be available through the Xbox store. So they're at this kind of impasse. And what I find kind of ridiculous about this is Apple actually has several other competing streaming services available on the App Store right now. They're just not very popular. And the growing suspicion there is that the reason that those kind of fly under the radar is that they're not as popular.
Yeah, Apple doesn't care, but this they're worried about.
This has the potential to you know, really change the way people play games on phones. And at a point in which Apple is currently trying to get people to pay a monthly subscription in order to play special games on the iPhone, you know, the iPhone App Store, you know, Game Arcade has hundreds of games now that you know, it's kind of this special deal that Apple has worked out with game developers in order to get people to play, is in direct competition in a very kind of sideways fashion with this Xbox system. The difference there being that, you know, what Apple is offering are all very mobile games. They're games that are designed for the phone and they're meant to be played kind of, you know, with touching on the screen and it's meant to be kind of light and fun. Whereas this is what Microsoft is proposing is entire, you know, massive Xbox games that would be streamed over the internet. But it's still a, you know, a financial thing. Do you pay the, you know, $6 or $7 a month to Apple for their arcade service, or do you pay roughly the same amount of money to Microsoft for their game service? So, you know, Apple is hiding behind a very odd set of rules in order to say that Microsoft can't play in its sandbox, and it's really not fair. And it's interesting that this is happening just a few short weeks after Tim Cook was in front of Congress to talk about antitrust allegations against Apple. It's just kind of bizarre that this is happening right now.
What do you mean?
I mean, this is exactly one of the things.
One of the criticisms of Apple, yeah.
Right. It's really kind of fascinating how toothless that conversation was when you consider that in the weeks following that conversation, Apple directly blocks Microsoft from launching a competing service, and at the same time, Facebook launches a competitor on Instagram for TikTok. Like, it's really kind of odd.
Yes, exactly. Well, let's move on. We're running out of time. And Galaxy Note 20, there's two. There's Galaxy Note 20 and Note 20. You say the best, worst phone Samsung has ever made?
Well, they're great phones. You know, Samsung's top of the line phones have always been incredibly powerful, and this is no different. The camera in it is exceptional. The battery is great. The display is fantastic. But it's all stuff that already existed. You know, this is the Samsung Galaxy S20 Ultra, which has been out for 6 months now, and considerably cheaper. But with the addition of a pen, you know, the Galaxy Note pen that gets released every year. There's really not any functional difference between these two phones, which is interesting because this phone is $1,300 when you go to buy the base model, and it only gets more expensive from there. And it continues this conversation, Anne, that you and I have been having for over a year now, I think, about whether people are actually willing to pay these incredibly high prices for phones. You can go into a Verizon store right now and actually get a trade-in deal for a Galaxy S20 Ultra that is $700 off. The original price if you trade in your old phone that doesn't currently exist for this Galaxy Note 20. So it's really kind of interesting to see, you know, this is probably a safe business move on Samsung's part because it doesn't require a lot of new hardware and a lot of new research. Mm-hmm. But as to whether this is a good idea for consumers, if someone were to ask me between the two phones, I would definitely send them to the less expensive one because it's basically the same hardware.
Why can they pull this off? Are they counting on most people not knowing you or?
I think the long story here, rather the short story, is that Samsung had this product in its roadmap during a time where you know, people were very readily jumping at, you know, kind of whatever the newest shiniest thing was.
Mm-hmm.
And tried really hard to build a press conference around, you know, buying a phone in the COVID era. And I just don't think this price tag makes sense for a ton of people, you know, who are currently actively looking at kind of tightening their belt for the next little while, especially if the existing phone they have is good enough.
You know, I just read that there's an all-time high in savings in the United States right now. Probably not good for
exactly.
Tech. Let's see. Shark Week. It's Shark Week.
We are in the middle of Shark Week.
On Discovery Channel. I mean, it's probably what Discovery Channel is known best for now.
Yeah, that's true. You know, and one of the really interesting things about Shark Week this year is that it's actually something that can be streamed the entire event. You know, in the past, Discovery has worked really hard to take what it thinks are kind of the most exciting things and tease them online so that they can get people on the television.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, nowadays it's pretty clear that, you know, being able to stream these things is going to be important. And so actually, if you have either Hulu Live TV or Sling TV, and you can actually try free trials of each of them this week, you can actually go and just watch all of Shark Week that way.
What are you looking most forward to?
Honestly, the bit that they were doing, I didn't think this was going to excite me, but they did that teaser with Shaquille O'Neal, where they were going to put him in the tank, and I think there's something about him being as big as a shark that entertains me. Seeing him in that environment, like, I wonder if the shark would actually be afraid of him because it's the biggest person they've ever met.
Exactly.
So it would. Yeah, I'm really kind of curious to see that.
Okay, we will follow up with you next week on that. In the meantime, Russell Holley, contributing editor for Android Central. Thanks for your time as always.
Thanks for having me,
Russell Holley, again, contributing editor for Android Central. That is it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks so much for your time. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.